From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Kiev is burning tonight. Flaming tires, fireworks, the stench of tear gas.
Before an agreement was brokered Friday, the standoff between President Viktor Yanukovych's government and a loose coalition of anti-government forces was bloody and telegenic. Riot police shooting from rooftops at protesters on Kiev's Independence Square, protesters hurling Molotov cocktails and paving stones. As the death toll mounted, the cameras recorded a conflagration.
And look at it now, a plume of black smoke coming off the big burning tires that form the barricades, which are now the front line between the riot police and the protesters still holding the stage.
But while insurrection makes for great TV, complexity does not. American news mostly defaulted to Cold War mode, characterizing the upheaval as a confrontation of East and West, with Yanukovych cast as a client of Russia's Vladimir Putin in a country whose citizens prefer to look toward the European Union.
Ukraine is really the latest and the most dramatic illustration of the tensions, growing tensions, between Vladimir Putin and the U.S. It seems to be a replay of the Cold War in many ways because of what many experts see as Putin's Soviet-era world outlook.
Indeed, some protesters were warriors for Western integration. But some, including the most organized and violent elements, were ultra-right-wing nationalists, and some just angry about the government thuggery they were seeing on YouTube. Even as the smoke cleared and a liberalized coalition government beckoned, the simplistic narratives and die-cut archetypes did little to clarify the who, the what, and the why. As we shall hear in the next segment, not only can we not be sure of what we witnessed, we cannot be sure of the outcome. People of goodwill can agree, people of ill will can betray. But one thing is not in doubt. What the world watched was the result of the world watching. A hemisphere away in Venezuela, the government this week escalated a crackdown against citizens protesting against the crumbling economy and brutal political repression of leftist President Nicolas Maduro. Videos of marauding paramilitaries and photos purportedly of military snipers shooting at unarmed civilians have leaked out via social media. Amid a near-total news blackout, chances are you didn't even know about it until right now.
Capital cities are in chaos. Caracas, Kiev,
on the streets of Bangkok.
The images are stunning. The atmosphere, it's deadly.
The violence tonight in Kiev is a lot like what we saw 3 years ago in Tahrir Square.
And it's hard not to think of Tahrir ablaze in 2011. But 3 years after protesters ousted Egyptian dictator Hosni Mubarak, the heat hasn't abated. This week, three Al Jazeera journalists appeared at a prison court in Cairo and pled not guilty to charges that included broadcasting false news and aiding a terrorist organization, namely the Muslim Brotherhood. As Peter Gresta, one of those Al Jazeera journalists, wrote in a letter from prison, one side is deemed terrorist, and talking to them is an act of treason. How do you accurately and fairly report on Egypt's ongoing political struggle without talking to everyone involved? The Oscar-nominated documentary The Square turns a lens on the Egyptian revolution and its aftermath through the eyes of three very different men. Since it screened at Sundance in 2013, it's been updated numerous times to reflect Egypt's never-ending story. The authorities haven't allowed the film to be shown in Egypt, though it's been viewed by well over a million Egyptians thanks to enterprising hackers. I interviewed director Jahan Nujaim and producer Karim Amer at a screening at the Paley Center in New York City. Here's an edited version of that talk, courtesy of the Paley Center for Media. The first voice you'll hear is Karim, who talked about some of the challenges the team encountered while making The Square.
It's very difficult to make a film when the director keeps getting arrested. And Jahan got arrested, what, 5 hours after landing?
There was a reason why I was arrested.
There's always an excuse.
There were these checkpoints, and so they searched the car and they found a film made in 2007 called Egypt, We're Watching You, Sheyfinkum, which was about three women fighting for change in Egypt. And so they took me in for questioning because it was not the best title, Egypt, We're Watching You, to find as the country is exploding by military intelligence.
How soon after
the beginning of the protests, did you get there?
I ended up getting there, I believe it was the 2nd of February, and the military were already down in the street. Karim was there from the first day.
You know, I went down actually as a skeptic, to be honest, and thank God I was completely wrong. Something fundamental shifted in that square during those first 18 days. When you live in a country where you feel that your story has already been written for you, it's one of the most crippling things you can do to people. And that was really Mubarak's biggest crime, is he killed the hope of generations of Egyptians. And what was found in that square was, for the first time, they would have the ability to write their story. Witnessing that, I think, changed all of us.
The criticism of the film you hear most often is that it's narrow in its focus. It represents slightly lefty, liberal crowd.
You're following the emotional journey of the character. You're not trying to be a news reporter. We chose three characters who we felt actually came from very different backgrounds, and we wanted to go as deeply into their emotional story as possible in order to allow an audience to feel like they had actually been walking in their shoes through the past 3 years.
Their stories, I mean, Magdi's story is so tragic, and Ahmed, I mean, what a character.
Ahmed, I fell in love with immediately. I mean, here was this street poet. He's somebody that grew up in Shubra, which is a very poor section of Cairo. His mother sold vegetables. His father died when he was a kid. He was the first person in the family to have gone to 2 years of education, but taken every job you could think of, from being a cook to cleaning houses. You know, so he was representative to me of many of the youth who had come down to the square to demand something different for their life. Magdi was sleeping in a tent near to ours. He was the first person who I had long conversations with in the Muslim Brotherhood. It was the first time he had told his family he was part of the Brotherhood. And he starts to question his relationship with the Brotherhood. He was going through this fascinating change. Khaled was somebody I met through Cressida, his wife.
He's
the actor, and he could have been anywhere in the world, but he decided that this was where he wanted to be. He's able to be incredibly articulate during very confusing moments.
We won't know if this revolution has succeeded for decades. There is no way in which the goals of this revolution, bread, freedom, social justice, dignity, there is no way in which those things can be achieved in 2 years. What you can do is lay the ground for them.
I don't think he knew he'd be waking up to a camera for the next 3 years, but that gave an intimacy to the film that we would never have gotten otherwise.
Was it really 3 years?
That was almost 3 years that we filmed, and two years of editing.
When did you decide it was over?
Well, the first time was really when Morsi was elected, and that was sort of the political storyline. And it was a film that had three acts, and it made a lot of sense, and it was logical, from the bringing down of a president to the election of a new president. Yet we were on the way to Sundance with the film, and 2 weeks before we left, all of our characters were back in the streets, and Khaled was saying, this is our freely elected leader that is using the tools of democracy to create another dictatorship. And it became a much more interesting story, because it became about what it means to hold your government accountable, what it means to fight for true change. So we showed at Sundance, went back to Cairo, mm-hmm. and continued filming.
And the thing is also is that, you know, this is one of the most documented events in modern history, and it's one of the most important social events of the 21st century, and that's going to continue to be talked about. The problem in understanding this revolution and the problem why some people end up not having hope in Egypt is because we kind of live in this world where we get to see change's greatest hits. We see Gandhi liberating India. We see Martin Luther King saying, I have a dream. We see Mandela ending apartheid. But we don't spend 20 years with Mandela when he's in jail and nobody believes in him. We don't see Martin Luther King when nobody believes in him. We don't see Gandhi when he's at his weakest moment. And so when we look at change as it's happening, we're disappointed that it's not fitting into the beginning, middle, and end. And as filmmakers, it was very difficult because we're trying to find a narrative arc, right? Now, how do you find a narrative arc when the climax starts in the first 2 minutes? The dictator fell. How are you going to beat that, right? So you don't really even know where you're going. So the only thing we could find is that these three people who come from completely different walks of life are united by one thing. All three of them are unwilling to give up that sense of authorship for the future of their country and continue to come back to that square. And we felt that this was important because there's something happening when we start to see this image that you just saw of this iconic now shot of a million people bringing a country to a standstill by occupying a square. And we look today at what's happening in Kiev, we see the same exact image. We look at Caracas last week, the same thing is happening. We look at Istanbul, and we start to realize that this isn't just the Arab Spring, winter, or summer. This is a global paradigm shift. When it started off in Egypt, it was a very lonely fight between the Egyptian dictator versus the Egyptian protester. But when all of you and the rest of the world started watching what was happening, you leveled the playing field. Your witness provided protection for us. And that's the way that we can change the world today.
You're good. In creating a film that had so many built-in challenges, what was the hardest part of it? What was the biggest surprise?
I think a lot of times the process artistically mirrors the subject, right? And it was very important for us to really have this be a collective effort. So there were a lot of voices involved in the editing of this film, which made for a very long, messy process. A lot of arguments, a lot of, if you take that scene out, you will destroy the revolution and the story of the revolution. A lot of that, a lot of talk about, don't worry, we have DVD extras and places where you can upload. And so
We have a lot of DVD extras.
So ultimately, it did become a dictatorship where I had to work with, you know, a final editor and finalize the film. But that process that we went through involving all of these people that cared so deeply in what was going on, it would not be the same film without that. And it didn't help, I mean, the process of shooting. I mean, we had 5 cameras confiscated. Mm. I was arrested 3 times. Everybody on the team was arrested or tear gassed.
Ahmed, the main character, actually learns how to film halfway through the film. And he actually shot a quarter of the movie, which was unbelievable to witness. And now he is working in Egypt as a DP.
I want to thank you both for being here.
Thank you
so much.
Jahan Mujaim is the director and Karim Amer, the producer of The Square.
We're now living in the state of Tahrir. It has its housing department, it has its borders, it has its army, it has its way of feeding itself. It has all of those things. It doesn't have a foreign ministry.
History doesn't always move ahead. Sometimes it slips backwards. Case in point, in 2012, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of official U.S. involvement in Vietnam, the Pentagon quietly launched VietnamWar50th.com. The sprawling website includes a detailed interactive timeline of the Vietnam War. But historian Nick Terse, the author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, noticed that the website's version of the war seems stuck in the 60s and 70s, reasserting misinformation long since debunked by journalists, historians, and the government's own Pentagon papers. But Terse does admit that at first glance, the website is impressive, full of primary source materials.
The Pentagon papers are posted on the site. There's a big sprawling timeline with 800 historical entries spanning from the 1800s all the way to the 1970s. It looks like an impressive historical offering, but when you look closer, you find that there are some real problems there.
Yeah, you don't actually have to look all that closely, because the problems begin with the moment of the U.S.'s major escalation of the war after the so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident, when North Vietnamese torpedo boats supposedly on consecutive days attacked U.S. warships in the Gulf. Here's President Johnson on August 4th, 1964.
Repeated acts of violence against the armed forces of the United States must be met not only with alert defense, but with positive reply.
A story that has been turned upside down by historians looking at documentation. And yet,
when you look at the timeline entries on the Department of Defense's website, you find that they've stuck to the original narrative, what people were told back in 1964, that a second attack took place, that U.S. ships were sailing innocently through the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of North Vietnam. We know now, of course, that American ships were there because there were covert raids being carried out on the North Vietnamese coast, and that's why there was a first attack on a U.S. ship. The second attack on a U.S. ship actually never took place, but none of this appears in the timeline.
One of the great horrors of the war, the My Lai Massacre, significantly turned the public against U.S. involvement in Vietnam. Here's veteran Ronald Lee Ridenour, who in 1969 first disclosed the killing spree at My Lai.
They had seen individual soldiers and some of the officers going through the village. And as they swept through the village, if there were people standing by the side of the trail, they just gunned them down, that they shot them. They saw them, these people shot with no provocation.
When the My Lai scandal broke in 1969, the U.S. military took great pains to refer to it as an incident and not a massacre. And the entry in the timeline sticks to this playbook. The entry also lists the number of civilians killed as more than 200 instead of more than 500. And it singles out only Lieutenant William Calley as being responsible for the massacre. Now, Calley certainly had plenty of blood on his hands, but it's farcical to make it seem as if the deaths of 500 civilians could be the fault of a lone junior officer.
Is it that the events to this day are controversial, or is the Pentagon simply ignoring all of our contemporary knowledge of what took place?
I think there really is a whitewashing that's taking place. There's another entry in the timeline that really stuck out to me, Operation Speedy Express, and that occurred in late 1968, early 1969. And the timeline entry says that the operation was a success and that 11,000 enemy troops were killed. But Speedy Express was really a bloodbath. It was 10 to 12 times the size of the My Lai massacre. And this is according to the U.S. military's own estimates that I found in long classified investigations files at the U.S. National Archives. In those files, the military admits that likely 5,000 to 7,000 of the dead were Vietnamese civilians, so about 60% of those 11,000 killed. But the Pentagon offers up a completely sanitized history of this operation, information that's false by their own records.
Now, one of the great scandals of the war was the revelation that there had been a parallel war going on, a secret war launched with President Nixon's approval in Cambodia. He bypassed Congress. He even bypassed some of his own military brass. Does the timeline do justice to those events?
That's another glaring mistake in the timeline. There's an entry in March 1969 for Operation Menu. This is what we know as the secret bombing of Cambodia. The timeline entry, I noticed, had a picture of President Nixon from a press conference apparently announcing the strikes and pointing out on a map where they were taking place. I knew that this was a gross deception. The strikes were covered up through a vast conspiracy that involved coded messages, burned documents. It actually took him 4 years to even admit that these covert attacks took place. But the Pentagon's timeline is that this was all out in the open and Nixon was up front with the American people.
Now, you noticed these errors and you got in touch with the Pentagon. Were they responsive?
When I originally contacted the Vietnam Commemoration Office, I was led through twists and turns and didn't get any concrete answers. I was told that all my requests for information would be forwarded to Lieutenant Colonel Tom Crossan in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Immediately, the name rang a bell because I'd contacted Lieutenant Colonel Crossan dealing with my book, Kill Anything That Moves, and the information that I have in there from U.S. military records. You know, what he told me was, you know, though 40 years had passed since the end of the war, he doubted it was possible for the military to provide an official statement in what he called a timely manner.
And I gather he was exactly as forthcoming this time around?
I'm still waiting for him to get back to me.
So let's just assume that the U.S. government put its spin on history. How much does it matter? Scholars certainly are not going to turn first to the Pentagon to get the secret history of the Pentagon.
It's troubling because the site not only seeks to inform the American public, but it makes a special play for children in grammar school and high school with a special section for educators. The Department of Defense is peddling its inaccurate and misleading claims to youngsters, creating a false narrative about the war. And the Pentagon has, in some sense, unleashed a salvo with this website. They're literally rewriting history.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you very much.
Nick Terse is the managing editor of TomDispatch.com. His most recent book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, has just been released in paperback.
Coming up, the proposed Comcast merger. Netflix lovers, beware.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Lumosity.com, designed by neuroscientists to work out your brain in a fun and challenging way. Lumosity offers personalized training programs to challenge your memory, attention, or processing speed. Lumosity users can train from anywhere with a computer or from an iPhone or iPad using the Lumosity app. Visit lumosity.com, click the Start Training button to start playing today, and select On the Media from the drop-down menu.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The proposed merger of Comcast and Time Warner Cable has left a lot of people worrying whether their TV and internet bills will go up. But combining the country's two largest triple play companies, those that provide TV, phone, and broadband internet, could do more than reach deeper into our wallets. It could shape how many of us experience the flow of ideas. The deal would deliver 30% of the nation's pay TV subscribers and more than one-third of broadband internet subscribers, with no other choice, into the hands of Comcast. Susan Crawford, author of the book Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, has, as you might guess, a grim assessment of the potential impact.
This takes an already terrible situation and makes it marginally worse.
Just a teeny bit worse.
Well, in that this mammoth combined company is going to pass 62% of American homes and it faces almost no competition.
Hey, Time Warner and Comcast don't share a single zip code right now. So they're all monopoly powers in their specified areas.
That's true. And actually, back in 97, they called it the Summer of Love. The cable organizations divided up their systems and clustered their operations. It makes total sense for them. Here's what makes the difference. Right now, Comcast pays about a third or a half of what any upstart infrastructure provider would pay for programming. Mm. Comcast, when it bulks up with Time Warner Cable's additional customers, will pay even less than it pays now, making it even less likely that a new competitor will be able to show up.
How would this merger affect, potentially, the kind of programming we get?
Every content provider has to deal with Comcast requests for payment, preferential treatment given to their own partners. And if you're thinking this is all just about video, forget it. This is about high data using applications. That could be distance education, telemedicine, home security. Comcast gets to charge whatever rents it wants to for the privilege of reaching its subscribers.
Let's say you really love House of Cards. It's a Netflix service. Whether or not you watch it on your television or on your computer, you're still streaming it. It's not being broadcast. So what can Comcast do to House of Cards?
Comcast can really mess with Netflix. It can force Netflix's communications through a narrow gateway so that your viewing experience on the other end as a subscriber of Netflix is very shabby, you know, sort of lots of jitter, lots of latency. They can also charge Netflix a lot to get a better experience through their networks. And finally, on the user side, they can impose usage caps, and you'll bump into them if you start replacing your pay TV with over-the-top TV, and then that'll make you feel as if it's too expensive to watch Netflix in the future.
Look, the public cares about Netflix programs. They are growing interested in Amazon programming. Can that situation really prevail for long?
Well, we have two choices at this moment. One, we could regulate them, put a cop on the beat, or we could just build alternative networks. On Wednesday morning, the FCC announced that it's going to start work aimed at getting rid of a bunch of state laws that make it impossible for cities to make this decision for themselves, to decide whether or not they need an alternative network so as to route around the power of the cable barons. And many, many mayors across America are thinking about this right now.
A lot of cities have actively tried to create municipal networks. And the cable companies and the phone companies have done a really wonderful job of stifling these efforts in the crib.
That's right. The cable companies have managed to get 19 states to go along with the idea that it isn't right for a city to have anything to do with telecommunications capacity. We saw exactly the same thing happen when electricity was coming around. The private actors who controlled the trusts that had locked down electricity in America didn't want to see cities have anything to do with with it. It took FDR, it took enormous amounts of leadership, decades of political fighting, but we won. Now we're going through that fight when it comes to high-speed internet access. We're at least on the battlefield at this point.
Having completely jumped the gun about what's going to happen when this merger takes place, I may have leapt over a crucial question, which is that the merger is under review.
Absolutely. There are many other ancillary markets that are affected by the merger that the Department of Justice will be looking at very closely. What happens to programmers? What happens to the equipment marketplace? The FCC has a broad mandate in looking at this merger. It's supposed to protect the public interest, and it will be examining it for the next year. So we've got a long way to go on the regulatory review of this particular combination.
Although it sounds like what you describe, and I know we're full of metaphors here, but that like three-quarters of the horses have already bolted from the barn.
Look, I think the great thing is that the horses may have left the barn, but at least everybody's looking at the horses at this point. That the merger has really focused attention on the broken situation for information distribution in America. The fact that we're becoming a third world nation when it comes to cheap and ubiquitous connectivity. We should be making an upgrade to fiber. But it's not in Comcast's interest to do that. It has no desire to spend any more on its network. It is in harvesting mode. The problem is we're all being harvested, and our innovative and informational future is at risk.
Susan, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age.
As you've just heard, community efforts to build their own broadband services often have been stymied by barrier legislation of the sort that has been enacted in 19 states so far. This week, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said the commission would look to enhance internet access competition by, quote, examining, as one judge recently advised, those legal restrictions on the ability of cities and towns to offer broadband services to their communities. For years, lawyer James Baller has been leading the legal charge on behalf of municipalities.
I believe communities should have the right to choose for themselves. They're the most affected by the decision and should have the right to make it.
Stringing cable and fiber is a huge capital investment. Why would a city or a town, with, in most cases, diminishing resources, want to get into the broadband business?
Well, they don't want necessarily to get into the broadband business. They want an advanced communications network that will support economic development, educational opportunity, public safety, and that's what they're after. They typically go first to the incumbent carriers and ask them to provide the networks. The incumbents typically say that it is not economically feasible for them to do it, and then the communities are faced with the choice of doing it themselves, if that's possible to do, or abandoning their hopes of having access to the networks that they regard as important to their future.
What's odd about this circumstance is it seems that the commercial broadband providers, cable companies and telecoms, want to not have their cake and not eat it too.
That's good.
They pass on a given region because it's not clearly going to be profitable for them. And yet when the municipalities want to fill in the gaps, then the lobbyists try to stymie the municipal build-out. Is that what's happening?
That's what's happening. It seems that what the cable and telephone companies that do this are trying to achieve is preserve future markets when they figure that it's time for them to get around to them. Or they're fearful that the municipal projects will actually be successful and stimulate others to emulate those successes.
The cable industry trots out any number of very plausible-sounding arguments against municipal broadband, starting with the old standard that municipal government, with all of its bureaucracy, is incapable of delivering services the way the free market can. Do private companies have an advantage?
I think that if you were to go to the communities that have their own broadband services, you would hear them say that they're very satisfied with their quality, with the customer services that go with it. Prices are reasonably competitive. If you're talking about gigabit networks, Chattanooga was the first in the country. There are several other municipal networks providing gigabit service. And in addition to that, the municipal networks support the community's goals and objectives.
One of the arguments that the cable industry proffers is that it's too risky for fragile municipalities. I want to play you an ad that was run in Longmont, Colorado, in advance of a ballot initiative that would have authorized municipal broadband.
We shouldn't make the same mistake that so many other cities have made, because when they fail, it's the taxpayers who pay. It will cost upwards of $17 million.
And who pays for that? We do.
As Longmont residents, we'd like to ask you to join us in voting no on 2A.
Well, I can't speak specifically to Longmont, but in the typical case, public networks are backed by revenue bonds, which means that they're not at risk.
It's not coming out of the city's general fund. The city pays a debt service to the investors who are shouldering all of the risk.
Correct. But let me be clear that a project, when it is proposed for a community, will be subjected to extensive debate. The incumbent carriers participate very actively in that process, and they will go forward only if the leadership of the community believes that there is a substantial unmet need and that the project has a high probability of success. Communities are not the hicks on the back of a hay wagon, and when they make those decisions, they will be very well informed.
You were talking about what these municipal services can mean for the integrity of a community. Do you have a one kumbaya example that you can give me?
Sure. Lafayette, Louisiana, is one of the most conservative cities in the country. As Mayor Joey Durrell, he saw the benefits of fiber network and asked the private companies to provide the service. They refused several times. It ultimately went forward with a referendum and ran into opposition from Bell South and Cox Communications. During the referendum campaign, both the leadership of the Democratic and Republican parties worked shoulder to shoulder in support of the project, and at the end of the day, the project was supported by a landslide vote that has drawn thousands of jobs into the community. It's operating financially successfully, and it is, among other things, attracted an entirely new industry, the film industry. Secretariat was filmed in Lafayette, Louisiana, in large part because of the existence of their fiber network.
There's a tear streaming down my cheek.
Okay.
Free marketeers and municipal broadbanders living together in harmony.
Right. As Joey says, they each held their noses but decided that on this one exceptional project, they had a common interest.
Jim, thank you very much.
And thank you very much.
James Baller is the president of the Baller Herbst Law Group.
Coming up, how you can use a drone depends on where you live.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. At a Senate committee hearing on the use of unmanned aircraft last month, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California described her own brush with a drone.
I went to the window to peek out, and there was a drone right there at the window. Obviously, the pilot of the drone had some surprise because the drone wheeled around and crashed. So I felt a little good about that.
If Senator Feinstein is concerned about privacy rights in the face of drone technology, she is certainly not alone. A rash of state laws considered or passed in 2013 seek to rein in drone surveillance. They offer a patchwork of restrictions that seem to reflect the particular culture or business interests of individual states. Never mind that the FAA doesn't allow commercial uses of drones, period. Margot Kaminsky is executive director of the Information Society Project and a lecturer at Yale Law School. She's surveyed the legal landscape and noticed a trend.
Most of the states with the support, I would add, of the ACLU, have headed in the direction of regulating law enforcement use of drones rather than private civilian use of drones.
Very Fourth Amendment friendly.
Yes. I would say they're Fourth Amendment plus, given the current state of Fourth Amendment law. If the more recent Supreme Court case that I think it was 2 years ago, U.S. versus Jones, hadn't come down, it'd be fairly clear that there is no Fourth Amendment protection against drone surveillance.
Now, some of the laws seem to protect certain special interests and to project certain regional politics and anxieties. I'm thinking Texas.
Yes. The Texas drone bill is really interesting. The basis of the law is that if you are a private individual using drones to surveil other private individuals or other private property, that surveillance is illegal, unless you fall into one of the 19 exceptions. And the 19 exceptions include real estate agents, oil pipeline monitors, and a number of other sort of comically small carve-outs that probably are indicative of pressures on the Texas legislature.
So that kind of reminds me of Idaho, which seems to show an interest in protecting the farming and ranching sector.
Yes, the Idaho drone law says that in general, no person may use a drone to intentionally conduct surveillance of a person or a specifically targeted private property. It additionally points out that a farm, dairy, ranch, or other agricultural industry falls into those kinds of private properties.
For fear of animal rights activists sending a drone up to gather intelligence, evidence, and what have you?
Yes. What's interesting is that those animal rights activists would presumably already be covered by the law, but Idaho is redundant and points out that farms, dairies, ranches in particular are protected by their anti-drone surveillance law.
Now, if Idaho and Texas fear do-gooders spying on industry, it's not for no reason, right? Tell me about the River of Blood.
Before the Texas drone bill passed, there was this private drone videographer who flew their drone over a meatpacking plant in Texas and photographed a river of blood coming out of the back of the meatpacking plant flowing into a public Texan waterway. And that photograph eventually resulted in environmental enforcement against the meatpacking plant. But with the current Texas bill in place, it is likely that that do-gooder, the drone videographer, would be prosecutable under the bill.
The Illinois law protects one special category from surveillance by drones, and that category, weirdly, is hunters and fishermen?
The Illinois law criminalizes a person who uses a drone in a way that interferes with hunting or fishing. There's sort of a question of what interferes with means, right? So if a journalist or actually a PETA activist uses a drone to surveil a hunter or a fisherman, it's quite possible that they could be prosecuted under the statute.
I want to talk about journalism. There are a number of obvious and perhaps less than obvious possibilities for the use of drones, covering demonstrations and large-scale police deployments and so forth. Based on the laws that the states have passed so far, how have news organizations been affected?
Those laws require those who use drones to film to get the consent of the owner of the property that they're filming or to get consent of the individual who's being filmed. So if you're a journalist and they're reluctant to give consent, this is a fairly major hurdle. The laws that thus far have attempted to regulate private use of drones, such as the Texas bill and the Idaho bill, really miss the mark by overreaching into areas that should be protected by the First Amendment.
There's even a sort of stand your ground analog for drones in one jurisdiction, a little town in Colorado called Deer Trail.
So Deer Trail, Colorado is currently considering passing a drone hunting license ordinance where for $25, you can get a license to, from your personal property, take 3 shots at any unmanned aerial vehicle that you can reach. Yeah. The drone hunting license is subject to a full town vote on appropriately April 1st, 2014, so April Fool's Day.
What happens if the people in Deer Trail, while shooting at drones, bring down a black helicopter?
I think they actually get a bounty. There's a reward in place if you shoot down a federal drone that is identifiable by any kind of markings on the fuselage.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Margot, thank you very much.
Thank you again for having me.
Margot Kaminsky is a lecturer at Yale Law School and executive director of the Information Society Project.
On September 11th, 2012, gunmen attacked two American compounds in Benghazi, Libya. If you pay any attention to the news, you've probably heard that story. Well, you've probably heard some version of it anyway. News reports constantly referred to the four Americans who died there, but you don't hear much about who those people were. They often get described almost as an aside, with the same seven words.
Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans.
Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans.
U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed in that attack.
On the Media's Alex Goldman has the story of one of the men whose name you probably don't know.
Information Management Officer Sean Smith. In Benghazi, Sean's job was to make sure the electronics that American diplomats relied on worked. But of course, that's not all he was. In his life outside of the State Department, Sean was a husband and father to two kids. But in order to really understand Sean Smith, you have to understand the online world which he inhabited. One of Sean's best friends explains.
My name is Alex Giancharco, and I guess for the purposes of this interview, you're interested in my space identity, which is I'm the Mitanni in a silly little online game called EVE Online.
Calling EVE Online little is a misnomer. While it may look like a simple outer space shoot-em-up, even by normal online gaming standards, EVE is sprawling and incredibly complex.
What makes it unique compared to other online games that many people play is most games have small servers. So you'll be playing a game with, you know, maybe 50 people, maybe 100 people, maybe 1,000 people.
In EVE, there's 500,000 users who can interact with each other at the same time, which gets complicated. What's emerged in EVE over time are player hierarchies called alliances that, when run successfully, resemble real-world governments and control territory within the game. Like real governments, they broker and maintain peace between factions. They also steal, lie, and spy on each other.
You know, in other games, that's against the rules. EVE Online is more like Somalia in space on the internet, where there's no rule of law, it's just whatever goes.
Alex actually quit a job in corporate law a couple years ago, and now makes a living from his gaming blog, which primarily chronicles the goings-on in the EVE universe. Alex is so ensconced in the governance of his alliance that he doesn't even touch the space shooting aspect of the game.
Most of what I end up doing is managing things such that it's more fun for our line members to actually play the game itself.
In the real world, Sean was working to aid the government in the midst of touchy, sometimes dangerous diplomatic quagmires. In the online world, Sean was Vilerat, one of EVE's most influential diplomats.
Sean was not just some guy in EVE Online. He was the chief diplomat of the largest alliance in the game. He also created a diplomatic corps, which was based upon the State Department itself and how they handle things. So now instead of having one diplomat, which is what most alliances have, we had a chief diplomat, we had several diplomatic directors, and we had attachés who were liaising with the various entities that they were focused on.
Alex and Sean both got into EVE around 2006 through a website called Something Awful, which, among many other things, plays host to a huge EVE Online alliance called Goonswarm.
I founded an espionage agency in the game, and Sean was actually one of my first agents infiltrating a hostile alliance, and we worked very, very closely together on that.
It's important to note that when you infiltrate a hostile alliance in EVE, it's not like you enter some combination of commands and bam, you've infiltrated it. You have to convince actual people to trust you. It requires persuasion, patience, and creativity. Sean excelled naturally in these situations.
So one of the most significant things that he did was managing the diplomacy of Goonswarm during an event called the Great War. The Great War was a three-year-long conflict that racked all of EVE. We're talking about a internet spaceship war here that had about 50,000 players on each side trying to kill each other for 3 years.
During the Great War, the Goonswarm were young upstarts being knocked around by a much larger alliance called the Band of Brothers, who had partnered with a smaller group called the Mercenary Coalition. It was a rough battle. Goonswarm was outclassed and outgunned. So Sean took a different tack.
Sean just started talking to their leadership. And over the course of several months of just highlighting the fact that their masters had taken credit for their actions and basically pointed out to the entire game how the mercenary coalition weren't really mercenaries. Sean convinced them that they should actually try to stand on their own as an independent entity and actually live up to their name.
It worked. The mercenary coalition declared its independence, the Band of Brothers wiped them out as retribution, and then the goon swarm stepped in.
He managed to get this foe of ours to essentially destroy a large section of their strength, and then within about 6 months, the Great War was over, because without mercenary coalition backing them up, this entity was thoroughly destroyed. You're talking about entire regions and sections of space that are changing hands because of stuff that Sean had a part in.
In the real world, Sean's job at the State Department meant he was frequently in real war zones. He couldn't discuss the details of his work with his friends in Goonswarm, but they knew he wasn't always safe.
There was this period of time when Sean was deployed when the uprising in Sadr City was taking place. And so we would be sitting there chatting on the internet during the day, and he'd say something like, "Air raid siren," and he'd go off because they were getting shelled by these Kayatushas from Sadr City. So our conversations would periodically be interrupted by him getting rockets dropped on him, which was never very much fun, but that's part of the job. The last communication we had from him was, unfortunately, him saying, "gunfire," and then that was when the compound was hit, and we never heard from him again.
His friends were used to seeing him go dark. But when Vile Rat didn't pop up for a disconcerting period of time, the goon swarm began to investigate. One of Alex's friends contacted Sean's family and found out that he'd been killed. Alex, grieving, posted a tribute to Sean on his website, not realizing that he was inadvertently breaking the news of Sean's death to the world.
Well, one of the worst things about having one of your, Sean was one of my best friends, and we hung out many, many times in real life, in addition to spending every day on the internet with each other for 6+ years before he was killed. So we're trying to grieve through that and then dealing with the media. Pretty much every major entity in the Western world contacted me trying to interview me. But really what they were trying to do is trying to, get in touch with a crying widow, which is what the media typically enjoys putting on when somebody has been tragically killed. So I sort of ran interference for a while, and, obviously the family had no desire to be contacted or discuss this with the press at all.
In a contentious presidential election season, Sean's death became just another issue to fight over. In the world of EVE Online, Biorat's death brought warring factions together.
Everyone was in shock. But it was heartwarming to see everyone come together in a game where people are typically very hostile to other groups.
Space stations in the game were renamed in Vile Rat's honor. People built memorials, signs that stretched across space that read R.I.P. Vile Rat. And they met up in-game to talk about their friend.
This is Amano Kage. I just want to send my heart out to all of those who are affected, the friends and families of those who were murdered. It's never a good day when a good man goes down. See you among the stars, tough guy.
Goonswarm, Sean's alliance, all got together and shot each other as tribute.
The old joke in EVE would be shoot blues and then tell Valrat. Blues being somebody who was friendly to you. Valrat was the diplomat, so if you shot a blue, you would then go have to tell Valrat and sort it out. We got together a whole bunch of people on our side, and we just sort of blew each other up as a tribute, sort of a memorial free-for-all op.
What did you personally learn from playing with him?
Oh, I learned many things. That would take up a lot more than I can tell you in just one interview. I learned a lot about reserve, about judgment, about how to interact with people. I watched him take enemies and turn them into friends, which is something that a lot of people don't realize is even possible. You think somebody doesn't like you, and then you just don't even make any effort. And Sean taught me that the effort is almost always worth it.
Do you see conflicts unfold in the game now where you think to yourself, I wish Sean were here. He would have handled this in a way that I couldn't have conceived of.
Every day. I mean, he was my right-hand man. So yes, every single day.
Today and every day for months or years to come, people are going to be posting image macros and links all over Facebook and Twitter, telling us never to forget Ambassador Chris Stevens and 3 other Americans. And somewhere, floating deep in the New Eden star system, will be countless space stations and monuments to one of its most important figures. In EVE, no one will ever forget Vile Rat.
This story originally appeared on our great TLDR podcast. You can hear more stories by going to tldr.onthemedia.org.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, and Meera Sharma. We had more help from Kimmy Regler. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.